Good morning, everyone. So before I introduce myself, I'd like to take a moment to thank the organizers of this conference for giving me the opportunity to present some of the stuff that I'm passionate about here at FOSDEM. My name is Matthias. I work for ITEX. So we're a small but international company, and our flagship product is an open source PDF library. Besides my activities at work, I spend a large portion of my free time tinkering with open source software and PDF alike, as you will probably see if you would take a look at my GitHub page, which is linked on the slide. The topic that I would like to talk to you about today is about document security, and in particular, digital signatures in PDF, which is the reason why I am here at this open source safety dev room. So before digging into the main topic for today, I should perhaps take a moment to motivate why I care about PDF security and why you should too. So in recent years, paperless bureaucracy is becoming more and more of a thing, especially over the course of the last year or so. More and more people are being forced to deal with their paperwork remotely, whether it's in the context of work or, well, their personal lives, in dealing with government paperwork and so on. And, well, in the absence of actual physical papers to do our stuff with, electronic paperwork has taken its place in many respects. And in this context, PDF is still the go-to format. Now, why is that? There are a couple of reasons for PDF's position in this particular market. And perhaps the most significant one is the fact that it's standardized. So both the rendering and the file format itself are pretty well delineated. Once you generate a PDF, it's supposed to render the same way on pretty much every device. This is obviously a plus when you're dealing with legal documents that should look the same everywhere, so people can't like complain about formatting differences, obscuring the meaning of the text, and so on. So this is definitely the thing that people think of first when they hear the word PDF. The fact that it's a standard also means that there is wide support for it. So while Adobe's software still is the most significant piece of software that people use when dealing with PDFs, at least at the end user level, the fact that it's a standard also opened the way for more public participation in this regard. So by now, there are tons and tons of libraries that deal with PDF in some form, whether it's to generate PDFs or to extract content from them. But the position of PDF in this space is definitely well established. And part of that, or in large part at least, is due to the fact that it's an ISO standard. Now, the aspect that I would like to focus on today is perhaps a bit more narrow. So I would like to talk about some of the security features of PDF. And the reason why that's relevant, particularly in this context, is because as soon as you start involving bureaucracy, being able to audit things and attach a provable record of authority to PDF files is an important thing. So that's why most of the talk I will be focusing on digital signatures, but before that, let me try and discuss briefly what the aspects of PDF security actually involve in this respect. So before we can talk about document security as it applies to PDF in particular, let's take a step back and set the terms of the discussion. So what does it mean for a document to be secure? I've listed four aspects of document security here on the slide. So the first one is integrity. So that just asks whether the document changed or not. It's pretty self-explanatory. Then there is authenticity, which is closely related but not quite the same. So authenticity asks for a record of who created the document and in particular also when, if that applies. Then there's secrecy, so who can access a document? There are plenty of documents that you don't want anyone to be able to access. The final aspect of document security is safety. So that one asks what a document can actually accomplish or do without the user consenting to it. So as you may or may not know, the PDF standard has some provisions for embedding JavaScript into documents. And this can be done for legitimate reasons, such as form validation or dynamic content maybe, but it's also often abused by nefarious actors to, well, do all sorts of bad things, such as submitting form data to endpoints that they themselves control instead of the document author and so on. So this is also an important aspect of document security, which Unfortunately, I won't talk about too much today, but it's important to keep in mind, especially in context of the other factors here, in the context of the other factors that I've already explained. So now, how does all of that apply to PDF in particular? So PDF has multiple features that support any well, or support various subsets of these aspects that I just discussed. So the first one and most obvious one is PDF encryption. So that serves the secrecy aspect of document security, as the name pretty much implies. Then the second aspect, which is actually what most of this talk is going to be about, is digital signing. So that one provides both integrity and authentication. Then there's timestamping. Timestamping provides integrity in a slightly different way. So while a digital signature can be used to verify that the document that you're seeing was authored by a specific person, a timestamp proves that the document existed at a certain point in time and that it did not change after that. And then finally, there is redaction. So often when governments release previously classified documents, they have to redact portions of it to preserve national security or the privacy of the people involved. And also for this, there is support in the PDF standard. Okay, so enough abstract talk. Let's go to a more concrete example. Suppose that two companies, say Alice and Bob, and these names obviously weren't chosen by accident, have brokered a deal that is worth lots of money to both of them. So they want to engage in some form of contract. And now the question is how they could go about securing this contract. So this is a list of what the requirements might look like. So the first one is they might require secrecy to avoid leaking the terms of their contract to the competition because, well, that might compromise their position in the market. Then there is also the aspect of integrity, which is extremely important when you engage in a deal of whatever nature with someone. So we want to make sure that both parties agree to the same terms, and you want to avoid giving the opposition the opportunity to insert language that's convenient to them, but not to you. And then there is the authenticity aspect, where we want to ensure that the parties that actually end up signing the contract are who they claim to be. The first aspect that I want to discuss in more detail is encryption in PDF. So, as the commonly heard mantra says, you should never roll your own crypto. So, as a responsible developer, the first question you should ask here is why should I even handle it in PDF? There are other more established ways to handle document encryption, and some of these actually predate the PDF standard. So you might just attach your document to an encrypted email encrypted with OpenBGP, for example. That's one way to deal with it. You could also use arcane OpenSSL incantations to encrypt your files on the command line like a real power user. So if you know what you're doing, this is actually a perfectly acceptable way of encrypting stuff. It's just not very user-friendly. Then there are all sorts of end-to-end encrypted messaging systems around today. So Signal is perhaps the most famous of those. Then there's ProtonMail, what have you. There are lots of these. So yeah, then why should you use PDF encryption? Or in what cases, in what sort of situation would you want to use PDF encryption? So the advantages of PDF encryption are more or less the following. The most important one is the fact that it's part of the standard that defines PDF. So that means that it's in particular natively supported in most PDF viewers, which means that if you're catering towards non-technical users that don't just have to view or fill out PDFs, this is a way to accommodate them quite easily. If you use PDF encryption, you also know that the data is encrypted both at rest and in transit. Because, well, it remains within the file. And yeah, if you only, say, encrypt the files in transit by, for example, attaching it to an email and then people download the attachment and so on, you can't be certain that the data will remain encrypted at rest as well. PDF encryption also affords certain flexibilities that you might want to exploit. So, you have the choice as a document generator between using public key encryption or password-based encryption. You can even choose to only encrypt the main content of the document by leaving the metadata unencrypted for indexing purposes, if you would want to do that. And if you really want to go granular, you can even choose that only embedded files are to be encrypted. Okay, so let's discuss some of the concrete encryption features that PDF offers. So essentially, you can choose between either symmetric encryption or asymmetric encryption. In this context, by symmetric encryption, I mean that you use a shared password to encrypt and decrypt the file, which has a very low barrier to entry. Users understand what passwords are. The only restriction is that you have to share the password out of band in some way, because obviously you can't just distribute it together with the document itself. Then you can also opt for asymmetric encryption, so you encrypt the file encryption key with the public key of each recipient. So under the hood, this of course still uses asymmetric encryption, but the key to decrypt the file is encrypted separately for each recipient. The disadvantage of this is that, of course, the initial hurdle to set up good PKI in a way that users understand and can work with is pretty high. But on the other hand, it does offer much more flexibility, and it's also more secure in a way, because you don't need to actually distribute passwords to files in a systematic way. So as a developer, how would you go about encrypting a document in practice? So the example that I'm showing here is, of course, an example using iText. And what we're going to do here is encrypt a one-page document with AES-256. So there is some input file containing just one page that we want to encrypt using AES-256. So the example here is a bit wordy, but I'll take you through it step by step. The first step involves picking a user and an owner password. So you don't need to worry too much about the distinction between these from a cryptographic point of view, because the result is the exact same in the sense that both will allow you to decrypt the document. However, some viewers, or at least, well, viewers should in general behave differently if a document is opened with the user password as opposed to the owner password. Now, from a security perspective, this doesn't really matter, of course. But nevertheless, it's something to keep in mind when you actually write encrypted files, just so you don't, get surprised by an API asking for multiple passwords. So, after picking passwords, we also set some usage permissions, also for the same reasons, you don't need to worry about these too much. And then we set up the output writer to use AES-256 encryption with the settings that we just defined. Then we open some input and output streams, one for to actually ingest the input document and one to write the output document with the writer properties that we just set up here. And then we copy one page from the input to the output. And that's basically it. So on the previous slide, I demonstrated how you might go about encrypting a file using iText. Now, iText supports pretty much everything there is to support when it comes to PDF encryption. So it's an excellent choice if you're a Java programmer or a .NET programmer. But I imagine that that doesn't apply to everyone here in the audience today. So I've compiled a short, albeit very incomplete, list of libraries that offer open source PDF encryption support. So if you're a C or C++ programmer, you might want to rely on MuPDF, QPDF, or Poplar. All of these are very well established within the open source community already. They back lots of PDF viewing software used in Linux and so on. Then, if you're a Python programmer, you have multiple choices depending on what you're after. So, if all you have to do is ingest legacy PDF files encrypted using ancient RC4 encryption, and you want a simple library that doesn't have too many bells and whistles, you can use PyPDF2. It does the job. Then, if you want something slightly more feature-rich, you might want to rely on PyKPDF, which is actually a wrapper for a QPDF. So, in particular, it also supports everything that QPDF supports. And then finally, there is PyHanko, which is a Python library that aims to support basically all signing and encryption provisions in the standard. So, that one is also an option here. If you're a JavaScript programmer, then PDFKit is the obvious candidate here. Or if all you need is a viewer, then you might want to use PDF.js, which is, I think, Mozilla's project. Then if you're a Go programmer, finally, then one of the libraries that I've run across on the internet is Unidoc, which is a commercial, but nevertheless open source offering that in particular also does encryption. Now, full disclosure, if it wasn't obvious already, I work for IATX, but I'm also the main author of PyHanko, so I'm not entirely unbiased in this regard. So since we're in the open source safety dev room, after all, this is a topic that we cannot get around. So there are situations in which you might not actually want to do your encryption in PDF, in the sense that you might not want to use encryption as defined in the PDF standard. So the first most obvious reason is that it just increases the development burden. So yeah, the PDF standard is a very complicated and long document. So, well, if you want to support encryption in the way that's defined in the PDF standard, then okay, you're gonna have to do some work, or in practice, rely on a PDF library. Now, more say intrinsically, one of the other things that is true of PDF encryption is that it exposes much of the document structure by default. So, for example, unless you take specific precautions to avoid this, anyone can basically investigate how many pages a document has or whether it contains forms and a number of other things. So the content of the document is very much encrypted, and if you use a secure crypto system, it's next to impossible to actually, well, figure out what's in the document. Nevertheless, some of these more structural aspects can remain exposed. If this is a problem for you, then you probably don't want to use PDF encryption. So then there are also a number of issues with the standard itself. So the way the PDF standard implements encryption. The most obvious flaw is that older versions of the standard relied on the very insecure RC4 encryption method for, well, all its encryption needs, which is a very, very bad idea. I won't get into why here, but suffice to say that you should never use this encryption for new documents, only for, yeah, to read legacy stuff, basically. More damningly, the implementation of AES 256, as it's mandated in the PDF 2.0 standard, is actually not tamper-proof. So while it protects the contents of the document from being read by an unscrupulous adversary, someone with sufficient knowledge of crypto systems and the PDF standard could actually inject malicious content into the file. So it doesn't protect you from that kind of attack by default. And related to that, some viewers are actually vulnerable to exfiltration attacks, where by injecting malicious code into files, the viewer might leak some of the encrypted content to the attacker. So in the end, it comes down to the good old security versus convenience trade-off. It's the age-old problem in anything security related, basically. Let's discuss a couple scenarios here just to drive that point home. If you're encrypting static PDF files intended for non-technical users that don't have any dynamic content, forms, or whatever, then sure, you probably want PDF encryption. It's the most user-friendly thing here, and yeah, that's probably going to serve your needs the best. However, if all you require is encryption in transit and encryption at rest is not really a problem, then you're basically better off just ensuring that all your communication channels use TLS. If you not only need encryption in transit, but also encryption at rest, but on the other hand, your software is still in control of every step in the pipeline, basically, then you should still consider just encrypting the entire file as a binary blob. So just don't care about the PDF format, encrypt the whole thing using some established encryption library, and do your thing. In this case, you don't really need PDF encryption as such. And then finally, and this is perhaps the most important point, if you need your files to be resistant to intentional tampering, then you really shouldn't ever rely on PDF encryption exclusively. So you can, of course, use PDF encryption plus something else, but currently there's no machinery in the standard that allows you to encrypt a file and make sure it is tamper resistant at without adding other stuff. So there is a proposal in the works to add authenticated encryption to PDF, but yeah, that's moving through the ISO process, but that will take a while. In the meantime, if you need tamper resistance, then think twice before you entrust your entire architecture to PDF encryption only. The issue of tamper-proofing and integrity gives me a nice segue into the next big topic of the talk, which is digital signing. This part of the talk is divided into two sections. So the first one is about digital signing in general and the basic concepts that you need to understand to get the grasp on what digital signing entails. And then I'll move on to digital signing as implemented in the PDF specification. So let's start with some generalities about digital signing in the real world. So as I already implied before, digital signatures are an essential part of electronic bureaucracy in these times, and they're popular with both companies and governments alike. So in Europe, there is a bunch of regulation about the legal status of digital signatures and the rules that they have to follow. It's also part of many government workflows. For example, one example that you might have encountered in real life already is downloading official documents from your local government. When I need some document from City Hall, I can go to their website, log in with my government-issued ID card, download the relevant document, and it will be signed by the relevant authorities so that I can use it in legal proceedings if I would want to. Okay, now what is it that we look for in a digital signature, especially in a PDF file? So in general, we want the following three assurances. The first one is that we want to ensure that whenever the document is modified in some way, we should be able to detect that, and it should invalidate the signature in particular. So the signature should ensure that the document we see is the same as the one that was signed. Then closely tied to that, there is the authenticity aspect. So we should be able to not only verify what the signer signed, but also who the signer is. And then finally, which is there is the non-repudiability part of the equation, which essentially boils down to not giving the signer plausible deniability. So the signer should not be able to deny that he or she signed the document even years down the road, ideally. And it's particularly interesting to note that classical physical wet ink signatures don't really meet this integrity requirement, and arguably not really any of them. So this is really one of the areas where digital signatures have a clear advantage over physical signatures. So having said all that, let's go back to our example of the contract between Alice and Bob from before. Let's see how these requirements translate to this particular example. Before committing to signing the contract with Alice, Bob wants to know for sure that Alice will not be able to change the terms after he signs. So that's the integrity part. Then again, Alice wants to be able to verify that the signature is actually Bob's. That's the authenticity part. And not only that, she also wants to be able to prove that fact in court if Bob later denies it. So not only does Alice want to know who the signature belongs to right now, but she also wants to be able to verify signatures far further down the line, not only to herself, but also to third parties. And this is kind of what sets apart non-reproducibility from authenticity in the most narrow sense. So another way to state this authenticity requirement very succinctly is to say that signatures should be hard to forge. And this can be achieved using public key or asymmetric cryptography. So that's two words for the same thing, basically. And the core idea of asymmetric cryptography is that everyone holds two keys that are related. So one key is the private key, which you use for signing. That key should be kept secret. Then there is the public key that's used for validating signatures, and that key is publicly known. So I'm sure that what I'm about to tell you right now is old hat to some, maybe even most of you in the audience today. But let's briefly review what such a public key signature process looks like. Say that Alice is signing a document that she wants to send to Bob, just to stick to the same two people from before. It happens in a couple of steps. So first, Alice hashes the document using some hash function. So Alice hashes the document, and then she signs the hash with her private key and attaches the results to the document that she's about to send to Bob. Then Alice sends the document to Bob, so the document plus the signature that's attached to it. Then, upon receiving the document, Bob first checks that the hash of the document that's embedded in the signature matches the hash of the document that he received. So that ensures that the document wasn't modified in transit. And then, using the using Alice's public key, he then validates that the signature is actually Alice's. And in that way, he can then know that the document he received was written by Alice. So, if anything, you should remember the following two things from the previous slides. The fact that the private key is secret ensures that signatures are supposed to be hard to forge. So it ensures the non-forgeability and the authenticity of the signature. Then again, a strong hash function makes it easy to check the message's integrity. Now, this leaves open two questions. So the first one is the obvious elephant in the room. How can Bob justify trusting that the public key he has actually belongs to Alice? Because technically, all he did was verify that the signature was produced by the public key that he has. But how can he know that that public key actually is Alice's? So to avoid impersonation, Bob should still check that the key he has is actually Alice's. Closer tied to that is the question as to what happens when someone steals Alice's private key sometime down the road. Because, as we already said, Alice should not be able to deny having made the signature. So if her key gets stolen, this should not be a reason to invalidate prior signatures. And dealing with that is also a problem that's not entirely trivial to solve. Okay, let's deal with trust first. In the real world, this trust problem is solved by relying on entities that are called certificate authorities. So, briefly put, a certificate authority is simply an entity that certifies the relationship between a public key and its owner. So it basically tells you that some public key belongs to some person. Let's see how that works in practice. So let's say that Alice wants to request a certificate from some CA. The precise procedure through which this happens depends on the policies of the CA, so there is some variation there. But the two main ingredients are more or less always the same. So, of course, Alice would have to prove her identity to the CA using some pre-established means. For example, a face-to-face interview or sending a copy of her passport or whatever. And then she should sign this information using her private key to prove that she is also the owner of the private key involved. So once Alice establishes her identity and her key ownership to the CA's satisfaction, the CA issues a certificate to Alice. So this certificate certifies that Alice is the owner of this particular public key. And the certificate itself is signed using the CA's private key. Now, if Alice wants to send a signed document to Bob, what she does is she signs the document as she usually would with her private key and then sends along the certificate that she received from the certificate authority. Now, when Bob receives the signed document together with the certificate from Alice, what he can then do is extract the public key from the certificate, check Alice's signature using this public key. This would prove that the document was signed using the corresponding private key as before. Now, in addition to that, since Alice passed along her certificate that was signed by a trusted certificate authority, Bob can also verify that this public key belongs to Alice, and therefore, by extension, that the document originated from Alice. Now, this protocol isn't too complicated, but it does raise one obvious question, namely, who watches the watches, or who trusts the certificate authorities and why? Why should Bob take the CA's word for granted? And this is a hard problem. Now, the current solution is more or less the following. So a very small number of well-regarded and widely trusted certificate authorities have their certificates preloaded on most consumer devices. So that includes your laptop, some browser vendors maintain their own CA stores, and so on. And these certificates are usually called root certificate authorities or trust anchors. And these, in turn, issue certificates for subsidiary CAs, those smaller CAs that do the actual day-to-day certification out there. This creates a sort of kind of a federated trust model, if you want. So the result of that is that whenever you validate in an entity certificate, you have to build a chain of trust to one of these root certificates. And yeah, this does mean that it's basically CAs all the way down. So in the end, there is one, at least one root that you have to trust, basically based on faith. So you have to trust that they don't screw up. But that's the way it works right now. So having reviewed the basics of digital signing in the abstract, let's try and take another closer look at how this actually works in the context of PDF files. So as you probably know, PDF files can contain forms containing various form fields, and one of the types of form field is a signature form field. So these are basically containers for signatures, if you want. Other than that, the general principle is exactly the same as what we just discussed. So a signer obtains a certificate issued by some certificate authority. Then when he or she wants to sign, they hash the document, then sign with the private key corresponding to their certificate, and then they embed the result into the signature field in the PDF file. And then optionally, but that's a matter of taste, you can add a visual appearance for the signature so that it's somehow visually clear that the document was signed, but this is not mandatory. So to make all of that a little more concrete, let's do an example using iText and Bouncy Castle in Java. So this is a pretty bare bones example, because it wouldn't fit on one slide otherwise. But nevertheless, the general workflow is usually more or less the same. So there are a number of discrete steps here. So the first part is some standard boilerplate to read key material from a file on disk in this case. So in this case, I'm reading my certificates and keys from a PKCS12 file. So that's this this upper block here. Then I'm going to want to open a file for reading. So in this case, I'm opening a PDF reader on the source document. I'm then attaching a PDF signer to that. So I'm not working with a, say, usual PDF writer here. There is a reason for that that I'll come back to in a moment. And then I specify the name of the form field where I want the signature to go. Then I point iText to the private key that I just loaded from my PKCS12 file, and I tell it to use SHA-256 to compute the document hash. And finally, we call the signDetached method on the signer to actually produce a signature. So here's what the result might look like to an end user. In the previous example, I didn't bother with setting an actual appearance for the signature, so it won't show up in the document. But nevertheless, when you open a file, a PDF file that contains signatures, you can open the signature panel in Acrobat and take a look at all the signatures that are contained in the document, regardless of whether they have a visual appearance associated with them or not. And these signature panels will also list all sorts of information on the validity of the signatures, details about the signer, the provenance of their certificate, and so on. So this is basically the place to go if you want to drill down on a signature in the document as an end user. Okay, so that wasn't too bad, was it? So let's try to make it a little bit more complicated now. So far, the story that I've been telling was mostly about single signer scenarios. So cases where some person has to sign a document and then someone has to validate it, that's basically it. Now, it's an interesting question to ask what would happen if we would require multiple signatures on a particular document, say for a contract or something. That's not at all uncommon. So what happens in these cases? So let's say that Alice and Bob both need to sign the same document, maybe the contract from the example from before. So in this scenario, Alice would first sign the original document and forwards the document with her signature to Bob. Then once Bob receives the document from Alice, he can validate her signature if he wants, he should, and then add his own signature to the document produced by Alice. So one thing that's important to remember here is that the order actually matters. In PDF, there is no such thing as a parallel signature or something. So all signers have to add their signatures one after the other. So if you've really been paying attention, the question that I'm about to ask now is probably not that surprising. What about the integrity of a signature? If Bob adds his signature to what Alice signed, then he's changing the document, right? So wouldn't that destroy or at least invalidate Alice's signature? And yeah, well, there is a trick to avoid that problem. So the way this works in PDF is that we update documents by appending stuff instead of rewriting the entire document. So instead of building a new document from scratch when Bob would sign the document that was sent to him by Alice, what he does is he appends his own signature to the end of the file. And in that way, Alice's original signature, which is signature one in this picture, does not get demolished by or invalidated by Bob's. And the reason for that is that the original data that Alice used to compute her document hash is still left fully intact inside the file. So the signature indicates what part of the file it covers, and as long as you don't change any of that, you're good. So here's what that would look like to an end user. In this Acrobat screenshot, you can see that the signature pane contains all signatures that were applied in the correct order, and it validates all of them according to the range within the file that was covered by the signature. So if one of the signers tries to sneak in an update that's not allowed, say adding an extra page or modifying the content of some page using an incremental update, then the PDF reader should complain and invalidate the signature. So as you can see, this is what Acrobat does in this case. So we've talked about trust and we've talked about multiple signer scenarios, but there is one more topic in the context of digital signing that I'd like to discuss today. That has to do with the validity of the signer certificate in the long term. So generally speaking, there are two ways in which a certificate can become invalid over time. So one is the normal way, namely by expiration. So certificates all have an expiration date. So basically these just act as a dead man's switch so that by default certificates expire after some time. And it also makes upgrading to more modern cryptographic standards easier because, well, certificates just aren't valid until 30 years in the future when the cryptography that we use today might no longer suffice. So all in all, that's just a sensible thing to have, and it's very much expected of any certificate that it will expire in the somewhat near future. So the other way in which a certificate can cease to be valid is through revocation. So in contrast with expiration, revocation is an action that the CA has to take explicitly. And as the name implies, it basically states that the CA no longer trusts the relationship between the key and the certificate subject. So there are multiple reasons why a certificate could be revoked. The most common one is through loss or compromise of the private key, say a key gets stolen or whatever. But there are also more mundane reasons. Say, for example, an employee at some company leaves before his or her contract is up, and therefore their access has to be revoked. That's not terribly special. But regardless of the reason why a certificate becomes invalid, the bottom line is that we have to deal with the situation somehow. Now, the reason why we should care about this kind of situation is more or less contained in the question that's here on the slide. So, what happens to an existing signature if the signer's certificate expires or is revoked? We definitely want these signatures to remain valid because otherwise the non-repudiation property would be violated. For example, say if Alice would engage in some kind of contract with Bob, she could then deliberately lose her key and report it as stolen to the certificate authority and then claim that someone stole her identity when the contract was signed. And then Bob would have no recourse. And of course, in a perhaps more mundane scenario, we just don't want signatures to just become invalid after some period of time. That's also not a desirable property. Now, at the same time, if Alice's key would actually get stolen, then the thief could then backdate documents and pretend they were signed before the certificate was revoked. And of course, that's also a situation that we want to avoid. So, well, how do we resolve this apparent contradiction? In order to validate documents in the long term, we need some kind of way to travel through time and validate a certificate as it was in the past. And this is tricky because we can't really trust the signer to accurately report the time of signing as before. Otherwise, you could just backdate documents whenever you wanted, and that's not what we want in this case. So the way this is resolved is in practice is by embedding not just a timestamp, but a timestamp token into the signature. This is basically a signed timestamp that's issued by what's called a timestamping authority, or a TSA. And this TSA is authorized by some certificate authority to issue, well, good timestamps, so trusted timestamps. Other than this timestamp, we also want to embed some kind of statement from the certificate authority that basically ensures that when the signature was made, the certificate of the signer was not revoked at that time. And then combining these two, you can basically restore the situation as it was at the time of signing with a trusted audit trail. Now, to actually embed and validate such an audit trail in a PDF file, there are a number of different conventions, but the most important series of standards on the subject is probably the PADES series from ETSI, so the European Standards Body. And PADES has a number of compliance levels, so you can basically choose how rigorously you want to adhere to the PADES standard, and that reflects basically the kind of timescale on which you can guarantee that the signature will remain valid. And there are lots of variations on this theme, so I won't bore you with them here. So by now, PADES is a very widely supported standard, and you should definitely use it if you can. So as I did at the end of the section on encryption, here is a short summary slide with some libraries, some open source libraries that support PDF signatures. The list is a little shorter than the one with the encryption supporting libraries because, yeah, implementing digital signing correctly is just more difficult than PDF encryption. And this is essentially due to the fact that there are just a lot of different use cases for digital signing that all have their own different requirements. Some people want to be able to sign things using hardware devices. Others have their keys in memory. There are different profiles, trust requirements, and so on. Now, if you're a Java or .NET programmer and you have a digital signing use case, then chances are that iText will fit your needs. The digital signing API in iText is very flexible. It supports multiple scenarios, including signing with keys in memory, signing with keys that reside on a hardware security device, deferred signing, where the actual cryptographic machinery happens somewhere else. It also supports all the PADES profiles. Basically, there is something for everyone. So with that, I think it's time to wrap up and summarize what we discussed today. The PDF standard offers many native security features, including encryption, which is easy to use, widely supported in viewers and libraries alike. Now, the only caveat is that you should be aware of the limitations whenever you decide to use PDF encryption, so consider your use case carefully. Besides encryption, we've also spent quite some time discussing PDF signatures. The digital signature feature set of the PDF standard is very broad and can more or less be mapped onto any PKI workflow there is. I could talk about that for hours. And governments and companies alike use public key infrastructure for all sorts of things, including signing documents. This makes PDF signatures a very worthwhile topic to learn more about. And then finally, there is the topic of redaction annotations, which we didn't discuss today for obvious lack of time. But basically, the PDF standard also has provisions to allow you to securely redact documents for publication or public release. So with that, I would like to leave you with some homework. Try and think about how you could leverage these tools in your document processing workflows. Thanks for listening. And if you have any questions, please ask.